Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Suspected insurgent hideouts in western Iraq today. They've cordoned off the town of Haqqaniya and are conducting house-to-house searches there. On Wednesday, 18 U.S. troops died on the first day of Operation Quick Strike, as it's being called. At least 24 Marines have been killed in the past week, making the first week of August one of the bloodiest of the war so far for American forces. Washington Post reporter Jonathan Feiner has an update from Baghdad. Jonathan, from your vantage point, what more do you know about what's going on the Western Front?
Well, this is a part of Iraq, Anbar province in the west. It basically stretches from west of Baghdad to the Syrian border, where the Marines that are policing that part of the country have had a lot of problems. They've launched something like six offensives since early May to try to root out insurgents from places, towns and cities along the Euphrates River and along the Syrian border, where insurgents, they believe, are passing into Iraq from Syria. And this is the latest in these operations. Clearly, it was prompted, at least in part, by some of the violence that's taken place this week. The Marines have lost 21, at least, members of their unit since Monday in a pair of incidents, one by small arms fire in which six Marines were killed, and then another when an amphibious assault vehicle rolled over a roadside bomb, and 14 Marines were killed in that incident.
All right, and several members of the Georgia National Guard were also killed on Wednesday. Eyewitnesses in the area in western Iraq say 500-pound bombs are being dropped in the area. Is this a different operation from what's been happening on the ground before?
I mean, I would say from what we've heard so far, it sounds like it's on the scale of some of the other offensives that have been launched in towns like Qayyum and Haditha and some of the other cities and towns out near the Syrian border. But it's certainly a major operation, more than 1,000 troops, including what the Marines say is a fairly significant Iraqi security forces presence in the operation as well.
And the New York Times is reporting today that once only a few dozen insurgents were in that area in western Iraq. Now there are more because of the U.S. troop presence. Is that true? Is that the thinking?
Well, I mean, there's certainly a line of thinking that says that once the U.S. goes through and clears these towns out and then withdraws, it essentially paves the way for the insurgents to then go back into a town that's no longer occupied by the U.S. forces. What the pattern has been is that they've gone into towns, cleared them out, the insurgents have sort of fled somewhere else, and then as soon as the U.S. is withdrawn beyond the boundaries of the town, they've simply gone back. And it may be the case that's what's happened in Haqqaniya and Haditha as well.
Well, and you write that a military spokesman said yesterday that the number of insurgent attacks is down, but that they're more effective.
That's right. That's the claim from the military here and from the Iraqi government as well. The Iraqi government has also maintained in a press conference yesterday that the intensity of the insurgency is decreasing and that the country security situation is actually improving. The U.S. military says that perhaps the attacks themselves have gotten more effective, but there are fewer of them.
Now, the deadline for the draft constitution for Iraq is a week from Monday. Is there still optimistic thinking that that deadline will be met?
If you talk to the government, if you talk to the U.S. Embassy, they will tell you they believe very strongly the deadline will be met. You talk to the participants involved in the Constitution process, and they'll tell you that there are still sticking points that remain over some key issues, the role of Islam in forming Iraqi law, the degree of autonomy that will be granted to regions such as Kurdistan in the north and a potential Shiite Muslim state in the southern part of the country, the rights for women, and several other sort of issues, sticking points that are still being ironed out in these last few days they have before the deadline.
Hmm. Jonathan, while we have you, we were reading in a news story today a footnote that gunmen stormed the Baghdad home of the spokesperson for Deputy Prime Minister Ahmed Chalabi. Again, he was an early American favorite candidate to lead a new government. And these gunmen executed this man, the spokesperson, in front of his wife and children. And that, Jonathan, is just a footnote in a summary of daily violence in Baghdad. What is the mood in the city among Iraqis and among U.S. troops?
To be honest, events like that happen with fairly shocking regularity to someone that's not paying close attention. But to those of us here, that's not a sort of a rare occurrence by any means. Political assassinations have been a steady part of daily life for people in Baghdad for several months now, and it doesn't show any signs of abating.
Jonathan Feiner, Baghdad correspondent for The Washington Post. Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We are delaying the start of our scheduled program to bring you the latest direct report on the atomic bomb attack on Japan.
That report was broadcast 60 years ago tomorrow, the day the U.S. B-29 bomber, the Enola Gay, soared over Hiroshima, Japan, and dropped its payload on the city of 350,000 people. It was the world's first atomic bomb attack, and it destroyed the city in a flash of blinding white light. 140,000 people died. 70,000 more were killed when the U.S. dropped its second A-bomb on the city of Nagasaki 3 days later. In a moment, the story of recently uncovered news reports censored by the U.S. government 60 years ago. But first, the events as they were reported on the radio.
CBS World News takes you now to Guam. Webley Edwards reporting.
The explosion was a big ball of fire. Anyone not having dark glasses would have received a visual shock several miles away. One of the crew members said, "My God," when he saw what had happened. What had been Hiroshima was a white mountain of smoke, and when we saw it first, it was already up to 25,000 feet. About 1,000 feet off the ground, it looked like boiling dust. It extended over most of the city, churning down there, and the center of the impact was in the center of the city, and the boiling continued several minutes as we watched. Then the mushroom of smoke broke off, and another developed below it. This one bomb is the equivalent of a 2,000 B-29 raid.
United States on the atomic bomb. Here's President Truman's statement.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. We won the race of discovery against the Germans. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war.
I could clearly see the city of Hiroshima within my bomb sight. Then I clutched in and took the run, and I felt the bump of the airplane. I was greatly relieved because I knew the unit had gone from the airplane that we had successfully delivered. It meant so much to the Army Air Forces, American science, and industry.
That last voice was Major Thomas Farabee, the Enola Gay's bombardier. He made that statement the day the atomic bomb, codenamed Little Boy, fell on Hiroshima. It would take weeks before Western journalists would see the devastation of the bombs firsthand. George Weller was the first journalist to enter Nagasaki, but the articles he wrote for the Chicago Daily News were never published until now. George Weller's son, Anthony, is also a journalist and author. He recently discovered his late father's accounts of Nagasaki and spoke to Here Now's Bob Oakes.
Let me ask you, first of all, the stories from Nagasaki were actually believed to have been lost forever. Tell us how you came to find them.
Well, my father died in December of 2002 at his house south of Rome, and a couple of summers ago I was going through the lengthy process of trying to just sort out a sea of papers that he'd accumulated over, you know, more than a half century as a foreign correspondent. And eventually, I simply found them amid the confusion in a mildewed crate. They weren't very far from where he'd been sitting all these years, and he had at one point found them and lost them again, and they just went astray in a globe-trotting life.
Tell me what your reaction was when you found them.
Well, I felt enormous relief because they were, to him, the great story that got away in a couple of ways from being censored first, and then when he realized he'd lost the only copies that were extant, it really broke his heart. And so I felt enormous relief for him and vindication, and then sort of astonishment at seeing finally, after hearing about them all these years, what was really in them.
What did you do with the dispatches? What have you done with them?
Well, the first thing I tried to do was get them in some kind of order and try to wrap my mind around them. Most of them are written in a kind of ready-for-telegram cable language that foreign correspondents were forced to use in those days because all their stories were sent by telegram. And the journalists routinely removed the obvious words from every sentence so that the editor back home would put them back in. So I've been sort of trying to organize them with a book in mind.
Your dad's reports include what are said to be some of the first descriptions of the then unknown effects of radiation. And let me read some of these words. "These patients begin with slight burns, which make normal progress for 2 weeks. They differ from simple burns, however, in that the patient has a high fever. Unfevered patients with as much as one-third of their skin area burned have been known to recover. But where fever is present, after 2 weeks, healing of burns suddenly halts and they get worse. They come to resemble septic ulcers, yet patients are not in great pain. But he adds later that most patients died after no longer than 5 days. I imagine when you read some of these accounts, they must have been chilling for you.
Well, they were chilling for me, and they're pretty much chilling for anybody. I think what astonished my father going in 4 weeks, almost to the minute after the bomb had hit Nagasaki, was that the Japanese doctors, who did not seem astonished by the total absence of American doctors and nurses, which is something that really infuriated my father, had already done an extremely careful job of cataloging the bomb's effects on each organ of the body. And they were able to predict, with many cases, how long somebody would live. And yet there were still many, many cases of what they referred to as disease X that had them baffled. People who, by all appearances, were fine, had survived the bomb, and then suddenly one day just died.
Radiation sickness.
Yeah, or people who were well enough and in slicing a lemon accidentally made a small cut in their finger the way any of us would, and then kept bleeding and just bled to death. Of course, at that time, there was a message actively being spread by the U.S. government via, say, at least a New York Times journalist they'd paid off, that this whole business about radiation being deadly was wrong. Then you can see his dispatches change over the first few days from his first impressions, which were of an extremely precise surgical strike, to, I would say, carefully contained horror at what he's seeing.
How did his experience in Nagasaki affect his later life and work?
He used to say that he lost his war at Nagasaki, that this tremendously important story was censored from the American people.
Now that his story's out, at least partially 60 years later, you're working on a book of his writings.
I'm going to be publishing via Crown, which is part of Simon & Schuster, a complete volume of all his dispatches, which are perhaps 30,000 words worth, and they'll include all the dispatches just from Nagasaki. And then my father visited a number of Allied prison camps immediately around Nagasaki, many of whose inmates were actually working in the Japanese industrial camps beneath where the bomb hit, so had pretty startling eyewitness accounts of what it was like to see the bomb come down or have it come down on their heads.
Anthony Weller, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Bob.
That was Anthony Weller, whose Pulitzer Prize-winning father, George, was the first Western reporter into Nagasaki after the atomic bombing there. And Anthony spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes. Well, just ahead, a look at the role of political forgiveness in healing the wounds of war. Why do some cultures seem to forgive and forget and others stay at war? Later in the program, we go to the front lines of a very different battlefront as a minister moves into crime-infested neighborhoods to take back the streets of Boston. There's more coming up here and now. Atomic bomb attacks on Japan. The world seems to have moved on. Japan and the U.S. are strong allies. Some young Americans have forgotten the impact of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the threat of Japan. Young Japanese flock to American universities. Of course, the two countries don't have to share borders, as some countries do. But why can't some cultures move on? The study of forgiveness is now one of the most popular fields of research among clinical psychologists in the U.S., with more than 1,000 studies published in the past 5 years. Bob Enright joins us on the line now. He's a professor of educational psychology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He's been studying the psychological impact of forgiveness on individuals and whole cultures for the past 20 years. And Professor Enright, can you tell us, first of all, has there been formal forgiveness between the U.S. and Japan?
there has not been formal forgiveness, and only the two sides can decide for themselves whether forgiveness is in fact necessary here. Individuals, in all likelihood, are still burning with anger, some perhaps even with hatred, for something that happened 60 years ago. If that's the case, then forgiveness might actually end up helping people, citizens, either in America or in Hiroshima, to get on with their lives better. A lot of times when people move on and countries move on, there is a tentative truce, but people have not come to a completion that only forgiveness can give.
We've heard incredible stories of people, you know, at Hiroshima, for instance, burn victims, who have forgiven the U.S. for the bombing, families of U.S. soldiers who have forgiven the Japanese. It's important for those individuals. Why, again, is it important for cultures to forgive?
Well, it does matter on the country level. If we just take, as an example, Kosovo, or if we take Northern Ireland, or if we take the problems in the Middle East, obviously there can be cultures that have an anger or an animosity toward other cultures. We think about reparations, which are important these days, but we never think about opening up the path of mercy, where we give a gift to those who don't necessarily deserve the gift as a way of reducing the anger and reducing the hatred. We can be civil, but harbor deep anger in our hearts. And we see that in Northern Ireland, for example, all the time. And I'm sure there are people in Hiroshima who are still quite angry, and not just those who experienced what happened on August 6th, because generations after that can still bear the scars. And it's the same thing in the U.S. with Pearl Harbor and other atrocities that have happened toward us.
You have been working with people in Belfast, Northern Ireland. You've been invited to Jerusalem about this thing I've heard you call political forgiveness. What does that mean to you?
Well, there's a difference between the action of the individual human heart forgiving someone else who might have been unjust to them, and cultures working toward one another and reducing anger and having more harmonious relationships. On the political level, a leader might say, "We forgive you," as Desmond Tutu did to the Afrikaners once in South Africa, only to find out the next day that his own constituents were angry with him because they weren't ready to forgive.
Well, what in your mind should the bishop have done prior to making that statement of forgiveness? I mean, what steps could he have taken with his people to get to the point where they were ready?
Well, first of all, he was in unexplored territory, as so many creative, bold people are, as Desmond Tutu is. He could have, in hindsight, gone to his constituents first and let them know he is thinking of offering forgiveness and see what they thought and to build a consensus. And very cleverly, what Desmond Tutu did the next day is he went back to the Afrikaners and said, "I am forgiving you personally." And he held that out as an example for others to follow.
There's a big difference, it's been pointed out, between justice and forgiveness. One sort of has legal ramifications. The other is murkier. How do you walk that path towards mercy?
We first have to open up the dialogue and make it possible for that to be part of the dialogue. It never has been, really, in the peace movement. We see snippets of forgiveness when Lech Wałęsa asked the Jewish people of Poland for forgiveness because of World War II. We see the theme of forgiveness, for example, in South Africa and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where people testify of atrocities and open up their hearts as best they can in the short time. And all of these have their place, but we must go much further than these.
Well, in fact, there's significant research that shows that if an individual forgives, blood pressure goes down, resting heart rate decreases, immune systems get stronger. I'm wondering, can you extrapolate from that research and say that whole cultures that learn to forgive are healthier?
Well, we actually have begun an intervention in Belfast, Northern Ireland over the past 3 years with children. Now, when they grow up and are leaders of their own communities, if we can keep them emotionally healthier now, don't you think that when they have to negotiate a peace, it might look different than if they're fuming with hatred that has been poured into them from centuries of propaganda?
But why do you think it is that some cultures can forgive and others can't? The U.S., for instance, with both the end of the Cold War and World War II, has reasonably good relations with those countries. But in other parts of the world, take the Balkans, for example, people still resentful over battles that took place hundreds of years ago.
I think it's the continued threat. If you think the other person is still going to kill you, you can forgive, but then that reconciliation theme is going to be much more difficult. With regard to the American examples that you give, in every case, the other has either surrendered or there has been at least a tentative peace where the threat has been reduced. To come together again in harmony, there must be trust. Forgiveness is centered in the virtues tradition that goes back to the ancient Greeks and Socrates. And so when you forgive, you become very hard-headed regarding what is right and what is wrong. You don't become blind to what's right and wrong. You become more acutely aware of it. And so when you forgive, you can get rid of hatred, but then see more clearly the path to justice and demand that justice. But when you forgive, you do not demand that justice with a club in your hand.
Bob Enright, professor of educational psychology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He's been studying the psychological impact of forgiveness and political forgiveness for the past 20 years. Professor, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Robin.
And stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. Rochester, Minister Bruce Wall has been patrolling a dangerous block in order to draw attention to the criminals that he says have infested what used to be a good neighborhood. Wall and a group of congregants took an apartment on Lyndhurst Street in Dorchester. They moved in last Sunday and plan to leave in 2 days. Here now's Matt Largy has been following Wall and has this audio diary.
My name is Pastor Bruce Wall, and it's Monday, August 1st, 2005, and it's the second day in the apartment on the corner of Lyndhurst and Washington Street. When we patrol the streets, we're basically making our presence known. We want to be in the neighborhood. We want people to know that we're here and that we're concerned and that we're very visible. We went out last night at 11:30, and as we walked the neighborhood, we saw a group of 10 to 13 guys and gals. And quite frankly, we felt that we ought not approach them, so we just walked, saw them, passed across the street. But one of my associates said that one of the guys pointed his finger at us and like he had a gun. He didn't have a gun, but he just pointed his finger. So we said, we can't let that go. So we walked back across the street and we approached the guy and we began to talk to him about the neighborhood. At the end of 2 hours, I was laying my hands on the forehead of this guy and I was praying for him. And I also put my hand on his heart. He responded. And you know what that made me feel like? He hasn't had a dad do that. So he has to be bravado. He has to be aggressive. Once we took down the strongest one with some love, the rest of them all came around. Because if he's talking to us, they want to know what's going on. We're in day number 3. It's Tuesday. After I woke up this morning, I read the papers to see what they were saying about the occupation. We tried to plan our day. The team came together. We planned our day.
Okay. So you want to do this thing during the day?
I want to do it during the day, and I think we need to do it around 2, 3 o'clock or so.
I'm sitting in the apartment right now. I'm sitting on my inflatable bed, and in this room we have 1, 2, 3 inflatable beds that all of us just purchased. We have 1, 2 lounge chairs. We have a couple fans. We have an air conditioner that doesn't work. Living in an apartment is like living in an apartment with 5 bachelors. It's an unbelievable experience. The men from my church and the other men who have come in from the community, those who have stayed for the duration are really bonding together as men. And they're making commitments to each other that when this is over, that A, they're going to come back to the neighborhood, and B, that we're going to stay in touch with each other because something unique has happened with all of us. Day number 4, I am exhausted. This morning, I had to go to my church and send out a schedule to the police. So I walk the neighborhood, and I walk to my church, and for the first time walking, I felt uneasy, and I felt that I had to turn around a couple times. I didn't like that feeling at all. But it's changed how I'm going to be able to function in this immediate community. I've lost my ability to be just an ordinary person in the neighborhood and in the community. Right now we're standing out in front of the apartment and we're waiting for the different men to assemble. Mike, we're going to go down Lyndhurst Street. It is 10:05, and our goal is to be out to about 12 o'clock. How you doing? Can I come and shake your hand? 90% of what I'm doing is to try to touch to the hearts of the people and to let them know that there's another way of living. When I approached this gentleman, my whole idea was, again, I need to reach the heart of somebody. So it's, hi, I'm Pastor Wall. I've just moved into the neighborhood. Can I talk to you? When they say yes, and most do, I go over and I talk about what we're doing and how we're trying to clean up the community and get the drugs out of the neighborhood. But I turn every conversation from the neighborhood to the life. And when I start doing that, people start telling me about themselves. And this guy said, I was incarcerated. I was in jail.
Well, my piece is a lot of the brothers that we're dealing with on the street, we're trying to challenge them to get into the mosque, get into the temple.
If all I was doing is running on the streets and being a crime fighter, I'd be fooling myself. Because unless people's hearts change, their mind is not going to change. If their minds do not change, their bodies are still going to act the way that they act.
Nice speaking to you too. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank
God bless you. God bless you.
It's Thursday, and it's day 5 of our occupation. What's different now than when I first came in is that the fear factor in the neighborhood has been reduced slightly, not completely. We've got a lot of work to do. In evaluating this, 7 days is really not enough to do the work that needs to be done. It just has brought a lot of attention to Lyndhurst Street and Cobham Square. So I'm in this for the long haul, and it's going to take a year to establish our perimeter in this community, and I'm going to take a minimum of a year and then keep going.
Pastor Bruce Wall of Global Ministries Christian Church in Boston. Wall says he's considering using the same approach in other neighborhoods. This audio diary was produced by Here Now's Matt Largy. And in other news we're following, Russian state television is reporting that a rescue vessel is now towing that mini submarine that was stuck 625 feet down on the floor of the Pacific Ocean. It's not clear how much oxygen the 7 Russian crew members of the mini sub had left. Their vehicle got tangled in a fishing net yesterday. Divers couldn't reach it, and the U.S. and Britain rushed robotic subs to the area to help. 5 years ago, Russian officials waited several days before asking for help in rescuing the seamen on board the sunken submarine Kursk, and at that time, all 118 crew members died. Also in the news, Canadian authorities are providing an explanation into what may have caused that Air France jet to crash in Toronto on Tuesday. They say the plane appeared to have landed too far down the runway, but they note that it's too soon to determine whether the long landing, combined with torrential rain, gusting winds, and lightning, were to blame for the crash. Here's Chief Investigator Ray Lavasseur.
There was lightning strikes and bolts around at the time, but none on the aircraft that we know so far.
And Lavasseur says the decision to land during a storm alert could be investigated. Well, still to come, we take a look back at the American propaganda machine during World War II and how it helped shape public opinion.
This, then, is the enemy. For total victory, we must make total sacrifice. Against the madness of Japan, nothing less than all our efforts will suffice to bring peace and security in our time.
Stay with us. Much more ahead. You're listening to Here and Now.
Thank you.
Today in Cleveland, Ohio, a prayer vigil will be held for the 14 Marine reservists from Ohio who were killed in western Iraq this week. Nine of the men killed on Wednesday were from the so-called Lucky Lima Company, which also lost two members last week in western Iraq. Back in May, the company lost an entire squad. Ohio isn't the only state reeling from such losses. The 48th Brigade of the Georgia National Guard lost 11 members in insurgent attacks in the past 2 weeks. But today, as Ohioans remember their latest war dead, we thought we'd speak with a city official who's got a unique personal perspective. Joining us on the line from Ohio is Michael Coleman, mayor of Columbus, Ohio, home to Lima Company. Mr. Mayor, welcome.
Great to be here.
And our, I guess, sympathies to you and Columbus as you go through the news of this week.
Well, you know, we've had a lot of tragedies out of Lima Company, out of this battalion, and we have to wrap our arms around these young people because they joined the Marines and the country called for them, and they're serving, and they're responding to the country's call. And, you know, I have a son as well.
Well, I was going to say, people, I hope, are wrapping their arms around you. Your youngest son, J.D., is a Marine in Lima Company. Have you heard from him?
I heard from him prior to this tragedy. I think it was Sunday night, Monday morning. Because of the time difference, he always calls in the middle of the night. And my wife and I jump up out of bed as soon as the phone rang. And to our knowledge, he's okay.
Well, and then you understand what some of your constituents have been going through, because I'm sure you were waiting this week for news along with them.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Every time the telephone rang, every time the doorbell rang, every time we even heard a car go down the street, you know, we've been through this many times now over the past several months, and it doesn't get any easier because the news of the events, frankly, we heard about this event on television. And my wife came running in the room and said, you know, turn on the TV. I turn on the TV, and we see 14 Marines killed in Hadifa, which is the city in which my son and Lima Company are serving.
Right. Well, Mr. Mayor, it sounds as if, and from reports we've read, the most important issue here is the human issue. But we've spoke to someone at the Amy Joy Donut shop, which is right across from the battalion headquarters in Brook Park. Mm-hmm. And she said what she's hearing at the counter is that people are really angry, and they are angry about the war. How do you feel about the war?
Well, I think on the issue of the war itself, and I have not been supportive of the policies of engaging in this war.
I wanted to say, too, you are a Democrat?
Yes, I am.
And so you were opposed to the war?
Well, I have not been supportive of the policies mm-hmm. that led to this war, but we are there. And we are there, and our children are there. And we want our kids back sooner than later. And at the same time, I'm proud of my son and every other son and daughter that's serving no matter how we feel about the war.
I'm wondering, what do your constituents say to you, especially knowing that your son is also in the company in Iraq? What are some of these families that you've spoken to who have had losses, or families who are worried about their children? What kind of conversations are you having?
Well, first of all, kind of two levels. Those who know that I have my son in harm's way over in Iraq, it means a lot to me that they would ask me about my son before even ask about me. And number two is they've been extraordinarily supportive of my wife, Frankie, my other son, who's a police officer.
So you have two sons in harm's way.
I have two sons in harm's way. Yeah. And then my daughter, Kimberly. To get that kind of support is the probably the most meaningful thing that could ever happen to me now. But those who have lost children, I've been to several funerals, and it's the hardest thing, one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life, and to talk to the families. But you know what? Just being around them, you know, you don't have to say a lot, because they know, I know, how they feel.
Michael Coleman, mayor of Columbus, Ohio. His son, J.D., is in Iraq serving with Lima Company in the Marines 3rd Battalion, 25th Regiment. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima, the beginning of the end of the war with Japan. Here's the sound of a short film from the 40s. It was made to run in American movie theaters. It shows survivors of Hiroshima a year after the bomb, wandering the rubble of the city, one man wearing only a dinner napkin.
A life of bare essentials is the lot of the little men who dreamed of world rule and ended up as host to Uncle Sam's occupation army. The trolleys are running, but a year later it's still a city of the dead. First victim of the atom bomb.
If that film sounds callous in light of the devastation at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it's a reflection of the time. For years before the bombing of the cities, the U.S. government pumped out these films and ran them alongside movies like Casablanca. They served many purposes, including the sale of war bombs, but Tom Doherty says they were an important, if sometimes embarrassing, part of the war effort. Tom chairs the Film Studies Department at Brandeis University. He's the author of several books, among them Projections of War, Hollywood, American Culture, and World War II, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks to be.
And can you tell us just how big was the propaganda machine prior to the bomb falling in Hiroshima?
Oh, it was huge. The Second World War is the first time that Washington really realizes that the mass media were going to be instrumental in fighting this war, not just in persuading people that the war was worthwhile, which December 7th did, but more importantly, the purpose of the propaganda was to teach Americans about the nature of the enemy and also to inculcate the skills necessary to fight that enemy, particularly the ethos of teamwork, everybody working together regardless of what your ethnicity or race happened to be in order to really wage this great war against fascism on two fronts.
How much of this was educating Americans as they prepared for war, as they were in war, and how much was demonizing the enemy? Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh, sure. A lot of the propaganda does both, but you know, I always kind of divided it into two kinds of propaganda in the Second World War. The first is sort of the kid stuff, the childish, racist, simian, offensive, the stuff we really cringe at today.
Describe some of it when it came to the Japanese.
Well, usually the Japanese were configured, as one wartime film says, as just sort of prints on a negative. They had no individuality. And then there was the brutish, buck-toothed, simian portrayal of the Japanese as kind of an ape-like creature. And you know, the universal use of the word Jap in newspaper headlines. It was just common parlance, of course. And we cringe at that stuff today. And from the point of view of the Office of War Information, the agency that was charged with orchestrating propaganda during the Second World War, this stuff really wasn't particularly useful. They wanted what the agency actually called properly directed hatred. Or more importantly, they wanted Americans to understand the nature of this enemy. And I think today we forget that from the time of the Meiji Restoration around 1871 until the end of the Second World War, the Japanese really were a brutal, aggressive, expansionist regime, unlike any other in human history in terms of the warrior ethos, where in battle after battle, the Japanese fought to annihilation. 97-98% casualty rates as you move from Guadalcanal to Okinawa.
This, then, is the enemy. For total victory, we must make total sacrifice. Against the madness of Japan, nothing less than all our efforts will suffice to bring peace and security in our time.
So the adult propaganda, as opposed to the kid stuff, really do respect the mettle of the Japanese warrior.
Well, we've came across a film that's sort of a hybrid of the two that you just spoke of. It's called My Japan. Now, the titles at the beginning of the film claim that it's a captured Japanese footage. But what comes up immediately is an obvious Caucasian pretending to be Japanese. Let's listen to a portion of it where this, again, American man with a bad accent pretending to be Japanese mocks the American lifestyle.
Now we tremble when you have to wait to get into movies, restaurants, nightclubs, sacrifices. What a delightful and foolish sense of humor you have. Or do you really take yourself seriously? We don't. We think you're stupid. An admirable quality for an enemy to have.
Again, this is an American-made propaganda film purporting to be a Japanese propaganda film, sort of using reverse stereotypes to do what to Americans?
Well, presumably to make them feel guilty that they're not sacrificing enough on the home front, comparing the the complacent American home front observer with the stalwart Japanese home front. That stuff is just, I think it was ripe even in 1944, that sort of material. And the Office of War Information really did attempt to try to make the propaganda a little more intelligent. Because you have to remember, everybody's frame of reference during the Second World War in terms of propaganda was the Great War, the First World War. And the propaganda there by something called the Creel Committee, the Committee on Public Information, was ripe and jingoistic.
And out-and-out lies.
Yeah, out-and-out lies. And so during the Second World War, people like General George Marshall and Frank Capra, who worked for the War Department making the Why We Fight series, really did want to give Americans a more realistic portrayal of the enemy. Now, not all of the stuff lived up to that standard.
And just to pick up on that, when you say that this World War I propaganda had out-and-out lies, it said things like the Germans were boiling babies.
Yeah.
When people discovered that, they were less likely to believe propaganda films about World War II and the Holocaust, which were true.
Exactly. You see, that's sort of one of the tragic ironies of World War II propaganda, is that anything the American propaganda machine during World War II could conjure about the evil of the enemy really didn't live up to what was going on.
But people didn't believe it.
People didn't believe it because their context was World War I.
That's right. Well, that's the backdrop. Let's listen to something else the narrator says. I want to ask you what you think is happening here.
Bob, your bombings particularly impress us. Tokyo, Osaka, Yokohama, drop your bombs. You cannot destroy Japan by turning cities into blackened rubble, by wiping out a few inexpensive lives. You're finding that out, too, I doubt.
Well, what are you hearing here?
I'm hearing some really bad propaganda, and I think the people at the Office of War Information must have been going crazy when they heard this stuff, because it's so ripe and ineffective. It doesn't teach Americans the lessons they needed to know in order to fight the Second World War effectively. And the best propaganda really did that. It told you to subsume your personal desires for the greater good. It told you to get along with your fellow Americans.
As much as people, maybe were seized by this propaganda after this horrendous attack on the country of Pearl Harbor, the first, in its history, did they then kind of feel a little, like taking a shower, sort of, backed away from it?
42 is the year of the hysteria and the worst of it. And then by 43, you can start seeing people rethink this. And even in some of the Hollywood movies, you start seeing, and the wartime documentaries, you start seeing officials differentiating between the Japanese enemy and the Japanese American citizen.
Tom Daugherty, film study chair at Brandeis University, also author of several books, among them Projections of War, Hollywood, American Culture, and World War II. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Each day this week in motion picture theaters throughout the land, Americans are remembering with vengeance in their hearts. Tears, too. Why not? Bombs are our weapons. Stop on the way out. You want to say what's in your heart? Say it with bombs.
That story was produced by Steph Katsonis, our colleague who's moving down the hall to NPR's On Point program. The story was mixed by Vince Fairchild. He's also going, but again, just down the hall. We'll miss them, but you will still be the beneficiary of their terrific work. Thanks, guys. Here now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The family.